You may not know this, but God isn't mentioned once in the Song of Solomon. So what the heck is it doing in the Bible? I wonder, is it there to make us wives jealous that other couples may have romantic poetry in their lives and we don't have it in ours? Probably not. It's far more likely there to encourage those of us who are in loving relationships to savor the sweetness just a little bit more. When you actually read the Song of Solomon, and you can, you know, it's only 8 chapters and it's poetry, beautiful words and language. There's a little bit of a reading guide on the front of your bulletin to give you some daily bites of it to read. You'll realize that most of it is actually a woman speaking, describing her passionate love for her mate. Though not, what a good wake-up call for me. I probably haven't written a love poem for Ken since probably the first year or two of our marriage, and we're celebrating 32 years this month. So, but then I thought, Ken doesn't usually go around saying things like, "Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away." I think maybe we are the ones who really need that marriage retreat that's coming in a couple of months. And maybe you're thinking it might be a good idea for you too, and I promise you it will be a delight. We will not make you write and recite love poetry to each other. And husbands, just a few tips of what not to say in case you have an anniversary coming up. I thought we only celebrated important events. Well, if you really want to celebrate anniversaries, why don't you just wait and celebrate with your next husband? Or, oh, all right, we can celebrate, but do we have to celebrate together? I digress. But really, what is this Song of Solomon doing in the Bible? The early church fathers must have blushed to have read it, because even though it seems pretty tame for us today, this was highly erotic poetry back in the day. In fact, there were monasteries that forbade their monks to read this poem or this poetry because they thought it would tempt the monks away from their vows of abstinence. These lovers are mad about each other, and they talk about their feelings with abandon, using words that we hardly ever speak aloud. You know how it actually got in the Bible? The church fathers didn't read it like it was erotic poetry. They could not allow themselves to read it that way. Instead, they read it as an allegory about God's love for God's people. Just as these lovers were crazy mad in love with each other, so the church fathers say, God is crazy mad in love with us. That's how it made it into the Bible. Isn't that cool? But the fact remains that it is, at its core, essentially beautiful love poetry. And to give it its fair due, we need to read it that way. If we don't, we lose something. The language is so absolutely beautiful. I hope you will enjoy its rich sensuality, and that reading it, maybe even reading it aloud, will awaken something sensual and deep and joyful in you. And then I think as we read it, we need to pay attention to something else. Though it's not likely that King Solomon himself wrote it, this work is attributed to Solomon just like Ecclesiastes was. It's in the tradition of the wisdom of Solomon, the wisdom that generations wanted to pass on one to another, parent to child. But this piece is almost like an antidote to Ecclesiastes. If you were here and heard us read from Ecclesiastes last week, you heard us read some of the most famous verses about the seasons of life, but really at its core, Ecclesiastes is a book about the futility of all of the pursuits that we so stridently engage in this life. It talks about how all that is so much as chasing after the wind. It's written from a male perspective at the end of life, so it's interesting that Song of Solomon is more of a female perspective. And essentially, it says that all those things that men, and we women too nowadays, put our energy into, is not worth it. It doesn't give joy. It doesn't give happiness. It doesn't lead anywhere. The writer says that there's no amount of wealth or degrees or honors or even trophy lions that can make a man or a woman happy. And yet, don't you feel like we've all bought into the elusive pursuit of happiness that our Declaration of Independence tells us is our God-given right? Happiness is not a bad thing at all, but the problem in our culture is that we've gotten too focused on that word pursuit. In an article in the most recent issue of Time magazine, Jeffrey Kluger says that the odds are that our dream for our kids to be the billionaire, the Broadway star, the Rhodes Scholar are just things that aren't ever going to happen. Yet kids are more and more pressured to be involved in extracurricular activities to pad their college applications. In public schools, he quoted statistics saying that students are bringing home an average of 17 and a half hours of homework each week. That's 3.5 hours per school day. But he goes on to say they don't have time to do it because over 10.2 million children in America are participating in up to 3 hours of after-school activities on any given day. And he says that figure has nearly doubled in the last 10 years. Kluger says there has to be, and I quote, there has to be a place where kids can breathe, where they can have the freedom to do what they love, and where parents accustomed to pushing their children to excel can shake off the newly defined shame of having raised an ordinary child. It's as if having failed in our own pursuit of happiness, we're pushing our children into the pursuit at an alarmingly frantic pace. And what that does is destroy the children's interests in the very things that they are wired to love. So pursuit may not be nearly so much what leads to the good life as simply enjoying life here and now in the ordinary places that all of us live. Eat, drink, work, love, play, live to the fullest. The Song of Solomon seems to say, God created us as sensory, sensual human beings with a capacity to enjoy life like no other creatures can. In fact, the sensuous description of nature in the Song of Solomon hearkens us back to the story of creation in that beautiful, luscious Garden of Eden where God gifted everything for the enjoyment of his earthen creatures. You and I need to be reminded that at the very beginning, there was not original sin. There was original blessing. It's as if creation itself is calling us to enjoy the life that God has provided for us. God pursues us so that we might revel in the delights that he has in store for us. Why is this book in the Bible? I think it's in the Bible to wake us up to the wonder and joy of living life and loving large, living fully into the loving relationships that God has gifted to us. Right now in the mornings, I'm using a devotional book for my prayer time called, it's by John Philip Newell, and it invites us to see God in the good life all around us. So I'd like to share one of John Newell's prayers with you. In the many details of this day, let us be fully alive in the handling of food and in the sharing of drink, in the preparing of work and the uttering of words, in the meeting of friends and the interminglings of relationship. Let us be alive to each instant, O God. Let us be fully alive.